I am honored to introduce to you our distinguished speaker, Maestro Manfred Honeck. Born and raised in the little Austrian village of Nensing, Maestro Honeck knew at a very specific moment when he was a boy that he wanted to dedicate himself professionally to music. At a New Year's Eve performance of the Vienna Philharmonic, a kindly usher moved him to the front of the crowd so he could see. The sights and sounds of the orchestra set his soul on fire. He studied violin and then conducting at the conservatory in Vienna. An audition came up for a viola job in the Vienna Philharmonic, so he switched instruments, won the position, and spent 8 years there. Maestro Honeck began his conducting career as assistant to Claudio Abbado and subsequently was engaged by the Zurich Opera House. He went from strength to strength, conducting orchestras all over Europe, including, just to name a few, the Berlin Philharmonic, the Vienna Philharmonic, and the Accademia di Santa Cecilia in Rome. In the United States, Maestro Honeck has conducted the New York Philharmonic, with whom he is appearing this week, the Cleveland Orchestra, and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, among many others. He has been the music director of the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra since 2008. His accolades have been numerous, including 2 Grammy Award nominations. What's more, in New York Times piece about Mr. Honeck, he is described as, and I quote, a mensch. No higher praise in New York City. That same piece states, quote, Catholicism permeates his life and has an influence on both how he programs and how he conceives of music. Let's find out how. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm welcome to Maestro Manfred Honeck.
Here is the mensch. Ecce homo. It is so wonderful to be here. Thank you for inviting me. And I learned today that today is the feast of Saint Vincent, and in Spain. And it was said that he spoke in later on when he lived in France. He spoke French. He spoke Spanish, but they understood him in French. So when I don't know, he was a holy person. How could they, in France, could they understand him when he spoke Spanish? How is that possible? No, they understand everything in French. So I hope that I speak now German and you understand English. As you realize, my English is not good. And if you have any question, please let me know. I try to explain in a different way, as I would do this also in the music. Well, thank you for inviting me. This is really a pleasure to be here with you. But I have to warn you, if you expect scholarly expertise, be it in theology or musicology, you might be in the wrong place. Not NYU in general, of course, but listening to a conductor who is not necessarily Nicolas Hanoncourt. What I will try to do is simply share with you some thoughts based on my own experience. If you think about today's talk's title, Faith in Music, you will certainly notice that it could mean very different things. Faith could refer to a very different set of beliefs, for example, to be 3 big monotheistic religions, Hinduism or Buddhism, and many others. Even if you are atheist, you believe that there is no God. To believe in someone and something as such is deeply, intrinsically human. Believing is fundamental to each one of us because it is a constitutive anthropological characteristic of every human being. In this regard, faith in music could also mean that I believe in music in the sense that I think that music is something important to me and others, that it satisfies a human need, that it is able to give an answer to existential questions in a more profound way than words. Finally, that I'm convinced that music itself has an irreplaceable future in the history of humanity. On the other hand, this type of faith in music has always been suspicious to me, if it is not relativized. While music can be something to believe in as humans, it will never be an object of faith in a theological sense. I mean that if music becomes the only expression of transcendental hope for somebody, it can become a golden calf to be adored. Human belief in music can never be a substitute for theological faith. As many of you probably know, I'm Catholic, and faith understood as one of these, of the three theological virtues, is really essential to me. I'm a conductor, and we are often the center of attention, or at least we think that we are. But in reality, we should not be. You listen Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, Bruckner, Strauss, Gershwin, and not to Toscanini, Karajan, Kleiber, or so who it is. And then I'm sometimes enormous amazed when CDs are coming out, you see the conductor, very big letters, and then down, small Mozart, Beethoven. My profession would not exist if this composer would not have composed fantastic pieces. So along from that perspective, humility seems natural, even more so in the perspective of Christian faith. Composer wrote music with their God-given talent. We interpret with our God-given talent. We just give what we received. I personally like to remember these truths before each concert, and sometimes I have musicians with me from different faiths, and we pray that our interpretation of wonderful pieces of music may touch the hearts and give glory to God. And I still remember when I came first time to Pittsburgh, musicians came to me and asked me, "Are you a believer?" Because of course I will not tell the orchestra in my inauguration concert, "I'm Catholic." I will not do that, of course. But they came to me and asked me, "Can we pray together before the concert?" I went to Philadelphia Orchestra, musicians came to me and asked me, "Can we pray before the concert?" It is amazing that classic music values are a little bit small, but things and words are spreading out. And one of the most, I would say, most impressive moment was actually in Prague, the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra. They asked me, "Would you like to attend a mass of Bishop Mali?" Bishop Mali was one of those, is Václav Havel, who was tortured by the communists. And he signed the Charter 77. And he could tell you a lot of stories. But he made a mass in my conducting room. That was the room where the Communistic Party has always made the decisions. It was so symbolic for me to be with the musicians. It was around 20 musicians, violinists and woodwinds and so on, celebrating in this special moment and a special place in Prague, in a former communistic country. So prayer is something enormously important to me. I think that this is what religious people often do. They offer their work to God and they pray that the Almighty may be part of whatever they do. If we ask, however, how theological faith, particularly the Christian faith, has its place in music beyond the individual piety of musicians, the answer will be more complex. There is a formal distinction between sacred music and secular music, of course, although the secular music might well have a religious dimension. If you think about it, the development of classic music in the Occidental tradition would be just unthinkable without its origins in Christian monasteries. Our whole system of notation, music is written as written from a form of art, goes ultimately back to monks who thought it would be helpful to write down melodies in a system they designed. And I come back here also to an experience I had in Prague 3 years ago. I always go to the hotel, an Augustine, Hotel St. Augustine. It's in the old part, and it was run by the Augustine order. But they sold half of this monastery to the hotels. Starwood is now a very nice hotel. If you go to Prague, please go there. It's a little expensive, but it's okay. But the monk, he told me, please come with me. So I went in the upper floor, it was on the sixth floor, and he showed me librarian. And he showed me the old book of notations of the choral, Gregorian chants from the 12th century. It was amazing, such a big book. But what broke my heart was all these original, wonderful paintings of the monks, they were thrown out by the communists because they want to sell it for private. So the whole book, it was unbelievable what the kind of wonderful paintings they had done. And then this, that's history. Their importance cannot be overstated. It is no surprise that the Christian tradition still has a privileged place in classic music, not only by means of past works performed, but by means of new compositions echoing this tradition. Quite recently, I performed the world premiere of a piece by Miloš Bock called The Apocalypse in Kamenická Strana. And here in New York, we had the chance to present with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra Macmillan's Woman of the Apocalypse. The tradition of musica sacra stems from the liturgical use of music. Music becomes an expression of prayer. It becomes prayer itself. This is specifically true for singing. Many of you know the famous saying attributed to St. Augustine, qui bene cantat bis orat, who sings well, prays twice. I always remind my people in the choir in Pittsburgh about this quote. What makes singing is such an intense form of prayer. First, our voice is the only melodic instrument we naturally have. Here the statement, I make music, becomes real in the most literal sense. When I sing, I'm a living instrument. The voice could thus be described as the most intimate instrument humanity has ever played on. Second, a sung prayer, and this is true for music in general, is deeply emotional. When the Bible talks about loving God with all your heart, think about the Shema Israel. It must involve the whole human person, all human dimensions, also the ones which are the most difficult to control, emotions and feelings. In singing, words are expressed in yet an additional language, a melody. This melody might infuse the heart with an immediate in the understanding of the prayer, even if you do not understand the words. I made one time an experiment. I changed the words of the song, and the words were completely nonsense. People started to laugh. Even could not understand anyone. The melody took them to the heart. So that doesn't mean that the words are not important, but it shows only that the melody can also touch your heart very much. Third and finally, singing is always a testimonial, a profession. Besides the realm of faith, this is also true in history as now for one of the most profound human dimensions. Love to another person. Singing has always been a privileged manner of confessing love to somebody. And this is also true for humanity's relationship to God. As you know, the word martyrium or martyrdom stems from the Greek witnessing, professing. And the old Romans were deeply impressed by the first Christians who professed their faith singing on the way to be killed. When I perform sacred music with soloists, a choir, and an orchestra, it is important to me to conserve the liturgical origins as much as possible, somehow creating a sacred space within the concert hall. This is why, for example, I developed a new way of performing Mozart's Requiem, a famous piece. Everybody knows that. But to present it in a different way makes something a little bit different. Maybe some of you had the chance to listen to this version at Carnegie Hall. When was it? Last year? I don't know. It's already history for me. But in this version, I embed the traditional Requiem in Gregorian chants, other sacred pieces and readings, with the main purpose of creating a sacred space. Of course, you could regard this tentative as unorthodox, because it neither corresponds to the usual performance of the Mozart Requiem, nor is it able to enact a real liturgy. But experience has shown, however, that it is worth to risk, and the risk, as not only the audience, but most of musicians are deeply moved by the intensity of this new way of performance. Although the Requiem is written for a Catholic Mass, the message of faith in this music is open to other faiths or beliefs. Why? Because death, the inevitable of every human life, is the most natural point of reflection about God, the transcendental, and generally about the sense and end of life. Now, I would like to share with you a little bit the concept, what I did with a famous beat, and you can do this also with other pieces, but I would use this example with the Mozart Requiem. And later on was what I would tell the musicians about the Mozart Requiem. I was thinking, what did Mozart himself, what was the circumstances he wrote the piece? And we know that Mozart was asked by a black messenger to compose this Requiem. He didn't plan. Normally he would refuse it, but he was in desperate need for money. He was gambling. He lost all the money. So the black messenger, we know who sent him, it was a count from Gloggnitz. And he offered him a lot of money, right, a Requiem. And this count had a little bit of a strange habit. He got this secretly, the manuscript of the piece. Mozart was not the only one, he did it also with other. Got the manuscript, copied it with his own hands, and wrote his name. The reason why he commissioned this piece from Mozart was he wanted to celebrate the 1 year anniversary of the death of his wife. Would you do that? To copy something from a wonderful composer. Strange, isn't it? But it was him. And I thank him. I thank him for that also. Otherwise we would not have a Requiem. The problem was Mozart died during the Requiem. But he did not know that. It was not finished. So Constanze, his wife, asked his students, Mozart's students, please finish that secretly, because I need desperately the money. So she went to, not to Mr. Süßmay, who finally did it, to Mr. Eibler, Franz Eibler, the best student of Mozart. But he gave it back after trying to finish it, said, I'm not worth to do it. This piece is too great for me. So finally, Mr. Franz Xaver Süßmayer did it. Constanze got the whole autograph and have given it to the Count and got the money. What he did not know is that she also herself copied it and sent it and sold it to a German editor. She got twice her money. Clever. But I must protect her because he, not today we have assurance of like this. In that time, 200 years ago, the Vaidovs, they were really poor, I must say. So I completely understand that she might, it's just clever. Salzburg cleverness. not only the Mozart Kugler there. But the problem started then a little bit that they had a concert in memory of Mozart's death 2 weeks later. And the Count had now performed this piece under his name in Wiener Neustadt, 60 kilometers south of Vienna. And stupid enough, there was some musicians played both the memory service for Mozart in Vienna and now this, and they were like, there's something, I heard it already, I played that. So who is it? So it started the rumors, you know, who did that? What is it? So finally, Mr. Süssmayr wrote a letter to the editor and say, well, I finished it, and then it was clear. But what, why I tell you this, I'm extremely interested always when I perform a piece. I want to know what is the reason the composer wrote it. Of course, Requiem is a mass for dead people, and Mozart was buried in the St. Stephen's tomb. What was the habit in the time of Mozart when he died in St. Stephen? Every mass was in Latin, of course. Was not in German yet, it was in Latin, and Gregorian chants were sung morning and lunch, evening prayer, anytime. So I put here incorporated Gregorian chants, and my idea was actually put the Gregorian chants not in the concert hall, not in the hall, like you would stay in a center of the St. Kitts and Stephen Cathedral, and you hear the Gregorian chants singing in a chapel where Mozart's coffin was buried, where he was. Just a little reflection. So outside. I start this version with 3 bell beats tuned in D. Why in D? Because the Mozart Requiem is composed in D minor. Why 3? Because the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And also I incorporated some readings from Mozart when he wrote a letter to his father, knowing that his father is going to pass away. And this is a wonderful letter, a letter where he says, the death is my best friend. I will never go to bed without thinking that I will not be anymore next day. A very emotional letter by Mozart speaking about the death. I took some other movements or pieces Mozart wrote for 3 Masonic friends who died in Vienna, a wonderful piece with a strange instrumentation, but very, very good. And also some texts like Nelly Zack's text, she was a survivor from Auschwitz, to have a link to our time. Anyway. This concept I did in Carnegie Hall and in somewhere also in Japan, in Tokyo, in Stockholm, and every time people told me afterwards, it is such an enormous experience for them. It's not the church service itself, cannot be, we cannot replace that, but you felt like it. And that's the thing what you can do with this wonderful music here in him. And I want a little bit, I prepared, I'm not a pianist, and please forgive me every wrong note what I play. It is, I'm a violinist, and you said already that's my, it's a viola player, and there are a lot of jokes about viola players, so I would like to hear another one if you have some of them. You play also viola, isn't it? Do you know a viola joke? No? I'm a joke already, so my own. I would like now a little bit tell you what I would tell the musicians and the choirs and the soloists when I work with them, because I think it is so interesting. And I was not planning to do that, but thank you for putting the piano here so that I might give you some example. And it shows a little bit also how Mozart himself was thinking a little bit also theological. He understood the text, the Latin text, very, very well. So, if you have here the famous Kyrie eleison, can you understand me?
Yeah.
Yeah? Kyrie eleison, Christi eleison. Lord have mercy, Christ have mercy. What did Mozart do with that? He composed a fuga with two themes. And the first theme is Kyrie, in that time, Father. Lord have mercy. Father have mercy. So. Was not me. What is very interesting here, everything is usual, but one thing is unusual. It's like the finger of God in Michelangelo's looked down. What he wanted to say, Father, to have mercy, you have to have sinned before. Kyrie eleison, you are on the earth. Father is up.
Dim, bim.
It sounds not very pleasant, isn't it?
Kyrie eleison.
So I always ask the choir, please emphasize it. You must be a God who have mercy, or give you mercy, but he's also a little bit kind of correct, yeah? Justice, thank you for that. Please help me every time when I make mistakes. What is he doing with Christ have mercy? He's doing that completely different, because Christ is the Son of God. He does Christ you see, completely different character.
This is Kyrie eleison,
very mighty God.
And here's the Son,
Christ eleison. You see, a little bit kind of like, only a little thing, but it makes a big, big difference. And the end of this Kyrie fuga is very interesting. And I made one time an experiment. And I do it with you now again. When it is you would agree, this sounds normal, isn't it? But it's not Mozart. You know what he did? You hear this? Wrong accord, wrong in the sense, you know, it's planned, you know. So why did he do it? Somehow, yes. But he questioned, Lord have mercy, Christ have mercy. I'm not so sure, but I get mercy. It must be a shock. So I always ask the choir, you must sing that like you are have put your finger in the electricity. Eleison, shaky. Huh? And then Mozart continued.
He finished it again. Every other composer would do this in a normal, but he is always bringing something which is very unusual. Listen to the last accord. Normally, it should be dee-bum, bim-bum, or dee-bum, bim-bum, or this. But he doesn't, he's very neutral with this accord. Dee-bum-bum. So you cannot define whether it's maggiore or minore. So why is he doing that? There must be a purpose, isn't it? He lets the question open whether you have mercy or not. Through a simple, simple gesture.
Well, this is one of the things which I'm so amazed. I can't tell you 100,000 things,
but if you have time till midnight, I can do this. But in the Rex,
tremende maestatis,
Rex tremende, the king. Huh?
Three times, Rex, Rex, Rex.
Three times Rex. Of course, again, Trinity. And normally, the choir always sings this Rex with big maestatis. No, I'd always tell them, you have to sing this like you stand, and this is the thing how I think Mozart sung, you are dead and you stand in front of the judge and you call him, Rex, please make me, bring me to the heaven, Rex. So not Rex like a big Schlagobers, cream cake, yeah? Rex, compass, no, shout to him.
Three times, it's very interesting. Another very interesting thing in the same movement is the, as you know, that Mozart was very ill when he composed that. And he was in the bed where he died finally also. And he had the feather in the hand and was writing. You know? And his wife, Constanze, helped him and some students helped him also. But he was tired and very desperate. He didn't understand why I am now ill, working on a requiem, and now I get something strange, you know? And there is a text in this. Salvame, salvame fons pietatis. Please heal me, save me. And this is a very personal request by Mozart. Because Verdi would so sing, salvame, salvame, Italian, salvame. What is doing Mozart? Salvame. Continue. Bam, bam, bam. Salvame. And finally, salvame.
Fade out and softly. So it ends extremely quiet. And I also tell the orchestra and the choir, you must sing that like somebody feel, go in the bed and be tired, or do like you be tired and ill, and write some music. And then you lose your power and energy, and you your head is going back to the pillow. And this is exactly the last diminuendo. And fade out. Now he's closing his eyes. Isn't it a great thing? Just a small thing, and it is already make a big, big difference.
Another thing is where it shows a little bit the theological knowledge of Mozart. He must have known that.
In that time, the hell, purgatorium, heaven. So in the Recordari with the four soloists,
what is he doing?
And they sing, neighbor, let me not be in the fire. Huh? The next bar. And then the third bar. So what is that? You can understand? You know already what I mean? Go to hell! Okay. The next is Purgatorio. It's a little bit higher. Okay. And the last one is the Heaven. Isn't it great? I'm so amazed. 100,000 things is like this. And I always try to explain a little bit. There's one thing. Quima, quimariam absolvis et latronem exaudis. Also, quimariam absolvisti. And I always ask the soloists, it's very dangerous to work with me, I know that. I ask them, which Maria do you think it is? Because, quimariam absolvisti. And nearly everybody tells me, if they give an answer, it's Maria the Virgin. No, it's Maria Maddalena. And in a time of, and still today, in the time of Mozart, they believed, because Jesus has Maria the prostitute, she was a prostitute, and has saved her. What is Mozart doing here? Everything is extremely tragic, yeah? Uncateus. And now he's playing Qui Mariam absolvis. You can do it very normal, but what I do is, I do it a little bit kind of this way. Qui Mariam absolvis et latrone absolvis. I do a waltz in it here. You will be surprised a little bit. A waltz in a requiem? It doesn't fit in. But you must know that in the time of Mozart, it doesn't exist today, there were certain rules very strictly. The Bayerische king and the king of Austria, they had given out a law that is forbidden to dance because woman and man are coming too close together. It was a law. Can you imagine? It was a law. They were not allowed to dance. And it had a lot of effect for the orchestra, for the composers, because they were not allowed to compose their music. Deutsche Tänze. And all the dance music disappeared for some years. And it came back. But because a waltz and dance music was regarded as dirty music. So now you see the concept. Maria Maddalena, the prostitute, and he put a waltz in it. So let's. Qui Mariam absolvantus regere omnibus. Qui Maria absolvisti taiontus re. 1, 2, 3. It's only a moment. Now, you don't have to know that. Just to feel it. It's okay. And I tell this always the orchestra. I want you now to play also the last 8 bars Mozart have written and composed in his life. It is the 8 bars of the Lacrimosa. Interesting. Mr. Süssmayr continued. Lacrimosa,
be from Mozart, isn't it? It's no difference, actually. Forgive me that I have... Oh, now I'm sounding loud again. that I put something, but I always find it so fascinating what kind of secrets, as a conductor, you can tell the people through the orchestra, and hopefully that the audience understand them. Well, the richness of sacred classical music is immense, of course. It would take too much time, unfortunately, to explore even the most important pieces which have become part of Western historical memories. Handel's Messiah, Bach's Passion, by the way, Herr, three times. Remember? Rex, three times Herr. Symbolic, a lot of symbols. Schubert's Masses and Gounod's on Schubert's Ave Maria, Verdi Requiem, Brahms Requiem, Haydn Creation. And this and so many more masterpieces have left melodies which could be recognized on the street by many people. Allow me to briefly also mention another composer who has a special place for me when I think about faith in music. It's Anton Bruckner. If a Baroque church comes to your mind when listening to many of Mozart's sacred pieces, in Bruckner's case, it would be a Gothic cathedral. For me, Bruckner is one of the most transcendental composers. If you would like to draw a Christological comparison, Mozart would emphasize Christ's humanity, while Bruckner emphasizes his divinity. Don't get me wrong, I think that both musical languages have both dimensions, but the accents differ. In Bruckner, the religious cathedral-like dimension is omnipresent, not only in his masses or motets, but also in his symphonies. And I would like a little bit to talk about the Bruckner's Ninth Symphony. Might be some of you were here when I had the chance to jump in them in the New York Philharmonic Orchestra for Gustavo Dudamel, who unfortunately was ill, and had the chance to perform with this great orchestra here in New York. He has written this piece, his last piece, 1890 till 96. He could not finish it, like Mozart's Requiem. He could not finish it. He had only three movement. The first movement is dedicated to God, and one small detail is fascinating. He was a strange person, a wonderful combative thing. He had a little bit kind of he was counting always the numbers. So when he was going on the street, he counted the windows of the houses, and he was really obsessed by that. And no surprise, you will also see that in the symphonies. And the first movement, for example, he took on the climaxes of the first movement the length of the St. Stephen's Dome, the height, and what is the breadth, into exactly the bars. It's fascinating. But once again, you don't need to know that. But it's just for me, it's fascinating, you know? And the second movement is a movement, a scherzo movement, where he describes a little bit of demonic world, especially this brutal Shakespeare-like. But my interest is the third movement, because he incorporates here the Latin Agnus Dei, qui dolis peccata mundi. Have mercy. Miserere nobis, and the end dona nobis pacem. And it is so wonderful how he puts that in the music, in the third movement. You nearly can sing it with the melody. So I would allow me for... Are you already tired? Is an hour or to have pay overtime? So
you've got 2 hours.
No, I've run out of the script.
So what he did, Agnus Dei. You can sing it with me if you want. So, yeah. half tone lower is better, huh? Nobody knows that. There is no book about that. But you know, I found it out, and I don't know why. Suddenly, I went to church in Vienna and had a prayer in front of the Eucharist, and I started to sing that. Agnus Dei qui dolis peccata mundi. I thought, oh my God, I have to look one time again into the score. And really, I believe very strongly in it, that he took the whole concept of an Agnus Dei into this, his last movement, an adagio.
Another place which is so beautiful to see. Peccata mundi, sins of the world, in the brass.
He doesn't like the sin. Therefore, it has to be a dissonant, which is very uncomfortable. It's not comfortable, isn't it? He could also write, but this is harmless, isn't it? What is he doing? Bam, 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 peccata mundi.
And it's even more when he writes them in the cieli bassi, this kind of.
Yep. It's a tragic passion march. The sins of the world, they carry a rucksack. So sometimes musicians offer me to play this very cantabile, like they would sing. I always tell them, no, you have to be the most sinful person in the world. You know, play it with accents. You must be desperate, dramatic. Sounded very good. This
and what he's doing then afterwards is so beautiful. When it comes to the point where it's Dona Nobis Pacem, he has again
always peccata, 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 mundi, the sin,
the sin. Then he finished it, and then he let play the flute.
One wonderful pianissimo. You know what I mean? Peccata mundi, mis miserere. 3 times. Miserere. Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Miserere. Huh?
Isn't it beautiful?
Just in one instrument.
It's, and then, of course, finally, the Dona Nobis Pacem. What a great moment, actually, in this score, then it's just, here in the very peaceful.
You see?
So peaceful.
And it ends with that
peaceful moment of Dona Nobis Pacem. give me peace. I think it is only so wonderful, beautiful. Once again, I could tell you a lot of examples, but the best would be to hear that, if you have the chance to go home and put it in a CD player. It's worth to look at it from the perspective of one who thinks about an Agnus Dei. You will hear this piece in a completely different way. Well, while Bruckner is maybe the most extreme example of how to permit symphonic meaning non-explicitly religious music with a message of faith, one might, however, reflect on how secular music written without an intended message of faith might have a theological dimension. Tchaikovsky 6, for example. Here, the perspective of the Christian interpreter or listener become crucial again. I know that I am in a Thomistic Dominican environment, but you will forgive me when I quote Ignatius of Loyola. It's okay? Good. Well, one of the most essential dimensions of Ignatius and the Jesuit spirituality is the principle of finding God in all things. This spiritual principle is rooted in the simple truth that God is creator of heaven and earth, can be found in all things because he made all things. Think about it, even if somebody abuses the creation, and we do it every day, this misuse becomes apparent only in contrast to its appropriate use. In other words, evil can be defined only in the light of good, as St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas pointed out. And since for Christians the work of redemption has been accomplished in the most shocking evil imaginable, man killing the Son of God, the flesh-made Word, God and Creator himself, we can find the suffering and redeeming Lord everywhere the creation is damaged, abused, and destroyed. In this light, classical music can have a theological dimension even when it breaks the form of tonality and immediately perceptive beauty. Think about pieces written during or in the aftermath of the two world wars, expressing the humanity's shock about the countless atrocities and crimes of these most devastating and unsettling historic events. I think here about, for example, Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony, called the Leningrad Symphony, and in particular his Tenth Symphony, which I will perform next week in Pittsburgh. He wrote this piece after Joseph Stalin has died in 1953. It's a 48-minute piece, a piece, 46 minutes. It's only drama, and really, I would say, harsh and nearly ugly, and 2 minutes of triumph. It's an enormous piece. Can't wait to do that. First time, please pray for me that I can do it. A Christian interpreter and listener will sometimes understand this music in the light of the crucified Lord. Ignatius, however, does not mention the principle of finding God in all things in the context of Christ's suffering. He allocates it in the contemplation of the final acts of God's redemption. Christ's resurrection. In the light of the resurrection, the Christian understands the full dimension of being a new human being. Once reborn in the dead and risen Lord, all things shine differently and become transparent to God. That's why for me, the most simple and evident experience of finding God in music is where beauty and form are most transparent. And this brings me back to Mozart as most shining example. I think here about the symphonic, secular and opera of Mozart. Mozart sounds so simple, playful and easy, and yet his music is most delicate and highly sophisticated. But foremost, his music, even in its darker moments, never breaks the deeply rooted convictions that the world is good and that there is always hope. For me personally, listening to Mozart always reminds me that God loves the world, his universal creation, and me in particular. Whether in Papageno and Pamina's by Menon welche Liebe fühlen in his 40th symphony, or the famous Andante of the piano concerto number 21, while different in genre and mood, Mozart's music always displays hope and often leaves us with immense joy. When you think about it, Mozart and also romantic or late romantic composers such as Gustav Mahler, Dvorak, used a lot of simple melodies, children's and folks music in their work. In this sense, classical music is not something created by the elites for the elites, but has a universal message. Particularly Mozart's Magic Flute, for example, and I'm not referring to the ideological Masonic background, of course, but to the music's message. It appeals literally to everyone. I think that this universality of classic music is very important. Although not all pieces are that accessible, for somebody who is looking for God in all things, however, music will be a privileged place to find him. From what has been said so far, one thing becomes apparent. The relation of music and faith is extremely deep and far-reaching, both in history and as profound expression of human nature. Think about all the aspects which have not been addressed here. The historic evolution of classical music in the light of political and social changes involving religion over the centuries. The general question about the universality of beauty and its relation to the scholastic transcendentalia of one God, good, true, or how certain instrument assumed certain traditional theological roles, such as the trombone for the final judgment. Jericho, by the way, Mozart used the trombone for the tuba mirum. In the Carnegie Hall, I had the trombone, therefore, because it represents God, I had him on the balcony. But God speaks to us from above. It makes a big difference. People doesn't know that, but they feel there's something mighty here. In this context of things not mentioned, I want to recall the Swiss theologian Hans Urs von Balthasar, who wrote a small book entitled The Truth is Symphonic. And I can't, as a musician, I can't say this. It's fantastic. You have to read it. If you think about the beauty of the sound of an orchestra, despite all the different instruments, which assume very different roles, you might feel that contrasts and seemingly opposed poles do not necessarily violate unity as long as each part knows and respects the roles of the other parts. I imagine that many of you are ardent listeners of the classical repertoire, and you will probably share the experience that the same piece, even if you have listened to it many times, still reveals new things. I can tell you that as a conductor, I have this experience all the time. This is just fantastic. It's not the same. It's no routine. It shows both how limited, but yet how infinite the human spirit is. La misère et grandeur de l'homme, how Blaisel Pascal would put it. Should you be by any chance not be familiar with large part of the repertoire of classical music, I can just invite you to explore. Particularly if you would like to find God in all things. Of course, you can like the sound of an orchestra, but still have your preferred instrument. Not all composers will appeal to you equally, but it's worth to explore. I would like to thank you again for coming, particular to you students or whoever it is, and to be invited who might have lost precious time to learn the for exams. Sorry for that, take the time. It was a wonderful time to be with you here and have the chance to bother you with some music from Mozart. Thank you so much. It's wonderful.
Store at the time, and I asked the owner, and he was an atheist, by the way, but I told him, I can't warm to Bruckner. He asked me, well, who have you listened to? You know, I named a few names, I won't name them. And then he said, sort of shook his head and handed me a box of the complete Bruckner symphonies conducted by Eugen Yoakum. And I took him home and listened, and it was a revelation. And then I learned that he was a very pious, devout Catholic. My question for you is it possible one's Catholicism can inform the interpretation of Bruckner and other, who was also a devout Catholic?
What about if a Jewish conductor conducts St. John Passion? Would it be good? Would it work or not? It works very well. I was a testimony of that. It works very well. We can do it. But of course, we have all this, the challenge. How deep do you want to go into the piece? Do you want to complete, understand a piece? If that means it's not only the notes and the music, the rhythm, the harmony, or like this. No, this is the least. This everybody can do that. No, but if you go into understanding Bruckner, you have to read his biography. You have to know his Tagebuch, the diary, about his thinking and what he really did. It's no secret that he prayed every day. No, and he made for every Our Father, he made, he counted it, you know? Once again, the counting element, you know? Yeah. He was very devout, and the spirituality, he played organ, you know, it's clear that he put a lot of things in. Now, as a Catholic, I hope, I'm not sure, but I completely understand our Catholic world. Yeah? At least, I try to find it. And I think that helps me personally a lot to get an angle. But by the way, Bruckner is not only sacred. He was a peasant boy. Also, he really had many moments where Austrian folk music was so important. Look, listen to the Fourth Symphony. It's the most, or the less sacred symphony of all of them. It's full of Wagnerian fairy tales, but beautiful also. He was an organist, exactly. Yeah?
Sacred pieces written by people without any faith at all, or for any other reason. Do you think that is possible to compose good or convincing pieces as the artist, say for commission or for cultural reasons or whatever, but they're not really believing it oneself? Have you found that? Are there examples of that?
So you mean when I make a commission, and I know that he's not a believer.
Right, yeah.
And I asked him to write a sacred piece.
Right.
But my answer is very clear. I wouldn't ask him to write a sacred piece. Might be. If I do it, I will ask him why I want to ask him. And there's a lot of, listen, we did talk about Tchaikovsky. Tchaikovsky was not necessarily a believer, but of course he was connected with the Orthodox Church. You know? But look on the Sixth Symphony, for example. Isn't it fantastic? There are a lot of, or the Fifth Symphony, the horns of it, is dedicated to love to God. He wrote it himself. The last movement of the Tchaikovsky Six is a tragic where a human dies, and exactly on a point where the human loses the struggle against the death, he dies, and he points out the tam-tam. He uses little drum, he uses cymbal, all the percussions, big drum, but not the tam-tam, only for the moment by the human ties. Those who understand the Orthodox world, tam tam is a very special mystic instrument. For example, Tchaikovsky. But there are, of course, other pieces like Jennifer Higdon's Blue Cathedral, for example. You know, it's also a beautiful piece and has a lot of spirituality in the piece. And I nearly found also, and please forgive me if I say that, if Johann Strauss, famous for waltz and entertaining music, sometimes I find there a link to God. Very special. Emperor Waltz, the opening, for example.
Do you see a similarity between orchestral work and figurative art? And the second question would be the crisis in the visual arts that we see is a deconstruction, is severely deconstructed as a medium. And why I just find as a figurative art that figurative art has been so deconstructed, it's very difficult to reconstruct it in contemporary cultural settings because people don't understand the necessity. Obviously, it's the incarnation is the inspiration, and it's necessary to reconstruct it in order to communicate with each other. Is there a connection with orchestral music in that way to incarnate through a unity and diversity? Does that make sense? I'm trying to draw a line between the two.
Yeah.
I'm trying to understand the two different disciplines of music and figurative art. And do you see a connection? Do you see a necessity to reconstruct?
Well, I mean, what we do in the orchestra, let me see the function of an orchestra. We have different instruments, different role of every instrument. If everybody would do what they want to do, it would be chaos. Listen, when you go to the concert, and the concertmaster giving the tune, the A, and then you start to tune and start playing all these things, it's chaos. So what we do, and the composers are doing, they organize that and define the role of every music instrument, of every group. So that means, what I said before also, you have to go sometimes to take you back sometimes. You have, because another instrument has to shine. If everybody plays loud, and it happens, by the way, very often, then the main thing is not coming out. As I said before, you know, you have to go a little bit back to that really the thing is coming out, what you really want to hear. It needs a lot of discipline and organizing. And I think this, the moment when everybody knows and is really organized, then the fun starts. Because we start then to really be creative. We start then to interpret. Because the interaction, and here it starts the moment where we, the music, because music is not, it's not a painting or a sculpture, you know? So music is, of course, is here, but it's a process. Once I have played a note, it's already history. Hopefully a good note, so, and a nice note, yeah? But it's already history. But if you paint something, or a building, acting, it is here. Once it's made, it is here. Or you will renovate or change something. Yeah? But the music art is a completely, an ongoing process of creativity. And here it starts a little bit, I think it's similarities what you do, actually. But without organizing, and without having a structure, what the composers ask, it would not work. It would, and I personally don't love that so much. You know, we had a little bit of experimental period in the 50s and 60s where every musician could do what they want, and it was worth to explore that, but it was actually not successful. Even the orders in Vienna, you cannot imagine. There was one time an evening with experimental music, and he put a glass of milk into the piano. Really? And I think, and he said this is music. No?
Are you sure?
Do you have a question?
Yes, a question. Many people in this room have quite a substantial musical formation. I'm one of those people who maybe does not possess that type of, I guess, musical literacy that many people have here. And I was just wondering if you have any advice for people, I guess in general, about how to begin to approach music like this, especially through the lens of faith.
Have no fear. Go for that. And take things. You brought an example. You had no idea about Bruckner, you know, so and didn't like it. Listen. But at least don't listen only one time. Listen more. Because classic music is so fantastic. And you will keep this the whole life. This is not a threat, you know, so it's true, because it is so fantastic art. And I believe it's really divine. I believe that Mozart could not write his Requiem if God would not be involved in that. I believe very strongly. The same with his book, the same with his Mahler. Mahler's second symphony. Start with that. Last movement, Resurrection. It's great.
I never brought up Gabriel Fauré. No, I wrote Requiem also.
Excuse me?
Fauré.
Fauré Requiem, yeah.
Yeah, and also Ave Maria and so on. Another, I think, very religious theme person, I guess. Can you tell me something about him, or your influences, the relations to him, or anything like
that? To Gabriel Fauré, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, as a French composer, he has a lot of influence by his colleagues. But Gabriel was definitely connected with the church and has also his background and knowledge about the religious faith, the Catholic faith. But I regard, and forgive me if I say this, a little bit more as a German composer than a really pure French composer. I don't say it because I could say Austrian composer, but you know, Debussy, Ravel, they are really absolute pure French. And Gabriel Fauré is, Cantique de Rojan, Racine, for example, isn't that great? Pavane is fantastic, the Requiem, as you mentioned, what a great dimension. These are people who worked in the church. These are people who are connected with the faith, and I believe there is something in here what God has allowed him to feel the music, to feel the text, and put it in the great music. I'm always touched by Gabriel Fauré's music. He's one of the great, and by the way, also a little bit ignored. At least in Austria, he's not so extremely popular. I think it is. It's a pity. I think we should really play much more of his pieces. Gustav Mahler. You talk to an Austrian, you know. I mean, he's one of my heroes, you know. And, but Mahler is, you know, he's Richard Strauss and Gustav Mahler both lived at the same time, and they have known each other. They were a little bit competitors, and whenever Richard Strauss has fantastic, beautiful music written, Rosenkavalier and that, you know, Four Last Songs and all these electrons, is fantastic. But Mahler was always interested in the sense of life. Mm-hmm. What happens after life? He struggled with that, like I do also. I cannot always give answers to things. I only try to give answers through my faith. But Mahler, he gave me sometimes answers how you could expect the resurrection or something. When he talks about love, third movement, by the way, this is one of the movement, greatest movement, the sixth movement of the third symphony. Listen to it. But the other side of Mahler is the Austrian folk music. And here you have to dance. But in Austrian way, that means the left voice. And do it sometimes a little bit rustically, so you have to buy some leather trousers and some elegance. Everything is in Mahler. He incorporates this change of the century, so wonderful.
Oh,
Okay, that's all we have time for. Thank you.